In 1959, nine friends went on a hike in Russia's Ural Mountains and never returned. Their bodies were found with a bizarre set of injuries, including head trauma, internal bleeding, and exposure, as some of them had left their tents without winter coats in Russia in February. 60 years later, the Dyatlov Pass incident remains an unsolved mystery, which makes Lauren Thoman wonder,
why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to Why It's Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we can rip from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it onto the big screen. I'm Mike Vago, author and regular contributor to the AV Club. And joining me this week is Lauren Thoman, a pop culture writer whose work has appeared in Collider, Looper, Parade, Pop Sugar, Vulture, and more. Lauren, thanks for joining us. Tell us about this bizarre real-life disaster incident and why it should be a movie.
Well, okay, so the Dyatlov Pass incident has been flummoxing researchers and conspiracy theorists for decades now. I first heard of it when I was myself on a hike with a group of friends. And, you know, it was nighttime. We were getting ready to go to bed. There's not really any sort of dark, like being out on a hike away from civilization in the dark. And right then one of my friends decided that it was the appropriate time to say, hey, did you ever hear the case of those missing Russian hikers? And so
that is the perfect like ghost story to tell on a hike.
And she wasn't even trying to scare us. She just was like reminded, oh, it's night and we're on a hike and it's, you know, we're out in the middle of nowhere. I'm going to bring up this story about these nine hikers that died under mysterious conditions. So, which in hindsight, she was like, maybe I shouldn't have told this story just now. So basically these nine college students, they were almost all of them were in their early 20s, except for this one guy who was 38, who was, I guess, just really into the idea of going on this long, it was a ski trip, really. They were these like really committed skiers. And so they were going to go through the mountains and with their skis. And so they started their trip on January 27th and only made it a few days in. Actually, there were 10 of them when they set out, but one of them wound up just making it one day into the trip and then leaving due to he was having knee and joint pain. And so he didn't think he could continue. So he turned around and went back, which wound up saving his life. And so the rest were these seven men and two women that continued on, and they set up camp on January 31st, and something happened in the night where what was found later, and they weren't found for another few weeks. I mean, there's a lot of things that could have happened in the interim there, but when they were eventually found, the group had split up. They were in little groups. None of them were fully dressed. They were all in various states of undress. They were all outside their tent. The tent had been slashed open with a knife from the inside. And they were all found several hundred meters or more away from the tent. And in these very bizarre kind of circumstances. So a couple of them had traces of radiation on their clothing. Couple of them were missing the soft tissue of their faces. Like two of the guys were missing their eyes. One woman was missing her tongue. There were two that had tried to, it looks like, build a fire or climb a tree, suggesting maybe they got lost. But the tracks were not consistent with them running from something. They were all looked like they walked away. So something happened in the night causing them to slash open their tent, walk away from it, but without their clothing, without their shoes. Some of them were barefoot, some were in socks. I think one was only wearing one boot. And then the clothing in the tent was kind of neatly laid out. And so it didn't look like they had gotten caught in the middle of something. It would look like they were in the middle of getting dressed or undressed. The clothing was pretty neat. So it was more like maybe they were in the middle of sleeping or dinner and had gotten disturbed. But from whatever it was, whatever disturbed them sent them out without time to get dressed, but not in a way that they were panicking and running, which is interesting. Also, there were several of them had significant injuries. So six of them, the cause of death was ruled hypothermia, but three of them, it was due to these catastrophic injuries. They had fractured skulls or chest fractures without any external markings, which would imply heavy pressure. And some of them had burn marks. So there are all of these very odd factors that have to be accounted for somehow. And over the years, there have been many, many, many theories about what happened to these hikers, but none of them account for everything. Like,
well, that's the thing about there being such a wide range of injuries, mm-hmm. that every theory explains some of them and none of them explain all of them and none of them explain the radiation.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is the most mundane answer, which might be correct, but then there's all these possibilities that it could also be. So at least one of the students was a nuclear physics student, and he worked at some sort of secret institute in Moscow. So it's possible that the radiation was from his workplace and that it had simply, you know, transferred to his clothing, and so it didn't happen at the site.
I'm just picturing the fuel rod sticking to Homer Simpson's jacket in the Simpsons opening.
Yeah, and it wasn't, you know, like glowing green radiation.
Yeah, but you'd have some background radiation from
trace. Yeah,
the job probably.
It's possible that he picked it up from his workplace, you know, or something along those lines. But, you know, it's also possible, like, there were reports of, I think they said it was fireballs in the sky from nearby townspeople from that night and in surrounding nights. They were saying, you know, it had happened a few weeks before, a few weeks later. So, I mean, it's possible. And, you know, one theory is that was, you know, missile testing that they were seeing some other form of weapons testing. But other theories are, you know, aliens, you know, it was UFO.
Right.
And so, but if it was west of weapons testing, maybe there was some sort of like fallout that got on their clothing, you know, whether or not that was involved, it could have carried with the wind. So the interesting thing I think about this story is it almost seems like there have to have been multiple odd factors at play to produce this set of circumstances, because no one explanation seems to account for all of it.
And I like that sort of as an ending to the story, that there's some just unlikely combination of, like, at the same time they were doing a missile test, then the Yeti also attacked.
Yeah. It defies Occam's razor, right? Because there is no simplest explanation that accounts for everything. It has to be multiple things happening concurrently, you know, and maybe it was a bunch of normal things, but just the fact that you have to have had all these different things happening together, I think makes for a very interesting set of possibilities.
And there's some things that, like, one of the chief theories is avalanche. Mm-hmm. And in fact, somebody modeled this pretty real, like within the last year, mm-hmm. saying that an avalanche could explain a lot of the things, like the head trauma, like the theory that this, you know, they sort of computer modeled or something, mm-hmm. that an avalanche could have crushed and injured some of them. The rest of them escaped and broke out of the tent and just ran. But that doesn't really explain why the campsite was found. You know, you said the clothes were neatly folded, like mm-hmm. the site was pretty intact.
Yeah. And so it's odd that, yeah, the theory is a slab avalanche, which is basically different than what we picture with a typical avalanche, because with a slab avalanche, it's like, oh, the whole top surface of the snow loosens and slides down as one big slab rather than, you know, the tumbling blocks of ice that we tend to picture. And so, and that would have come down and gone over the campsite. And they did say it would be consistent with the sort of like pressure injuries that this few of them sustained. Although then you'd have to wonder why they dragged them. It doesn't look like they dragged them, though, is the thing. It looks like the tracks show that they all walked away, and it shows that they walked, not ran. So
right. Could this have been they were hurt and they staggered through the snow?
Yeah, maybe.
It's also, as somebody who grew up in Buffalo, it's not that easy to run through snow if it's deep.
Also true. Yeah.
And so, if there could have been deep snow that's melted by the time they were found.
Yeah. And there were also, like, surely more, you know, more snowfall and, you know, wind and other factors that could have, you know, altered the scene. But the tent was partially crushed, but it wasn't completely crushed, you know, and you'd think that if several of their group were severely injured, they probably wouldn't have split up the way they did. I mean, it's possible that it was like, these people will care for the injured people and these people will all go and look for help. But being the experienced hikers that they were, it just is, it's a little bit odd that that would have been their tactic, is to leave their injured people and then split up in multiple different directions.
Yeah. And a good friend of mine is an experienced hiker, you know, in Oregon, and he hikes the mountains and he's hiked the Sierra Nevadas and things. And so much of preparation for hiking is like what to do in a disaster, what to do if something goes wrong, because the consequences are very severe if you're not near anybody and something goes wrong. So that would be in their minds. At the same time, if they're in a state of undress, it's probably in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. So something happens, it's pitch black. And I can see how, you know, a group of people would panic in that situation, especially if you can't see the others, you just hear voices, maybe you hear screaming because people have been hurt.
Yeah. So it's possible that like some went with the injured people and others went and they got separated, leaving the tent. And two of them were found looking like they had made a fire and tried to climb a tree. So maybe two that were separated were trying to find the others and keep warm. So, I mean, there are, you know, again, there are various explanations. It's just, there's no really way of telling what the right one is. And also, you know, with a slab avalanche, it's just interesting that part of the tent, that the tent wouldn't have been, the model basically shows that the tent should have been completely crushed and it wasn't. There also weren't, you know, when they found them several weeks later, they said there really weren't external indications that there had been an avalanche. Again, it's possible because, you know, wind and weather and, you know, maybe it wiped away the traces, but they just said the surrounding area didn't really seem consistent with an avalanche.
Right, right. And it's one of those things that, like, it's not a great theory, but it just makes the other ones make even less sense.
Yeah, yeah. And even,
like,
you know,
it probably wasn't aliens.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, who knows? Who knows? And the other thing that, you know, adds to the conspiracy theory fire is it being the Soviet Union in 1959, it was classified as secret, which actually was very normal at the time. Russia, they categorized everything as secret.
Right, right. But that's also catnip for conspiracy theorists.
But yeah, yeah. So when you say like it's this investigation that was closed by the Russian government and classified as secret, and then it wasn't reopened until 2019. Like, obviously, that's gonna sound very suspect. So it's like, well, what was the Russian government trying to hide? And I mean, the most plausible answer is in 1959, everything, right?
Right, exactly. And like, if you think it was a weapons test, then that just feeds that theory. But it's also very, very plausible that they had no idea what happened and just the Soviets didn't want to admit they didn't know anything.
Right, right. But at the same time, you know, there's all these incidental pieces that make it seem like something nefarious.
Yeah, sinister. Yeah.
You know, like there's one police officer that was part of the initial investigation that then went and said that he was told by high-ranking officials not to include the like possibility of like not to include mention of the lights in the sky. And so you know, and so it's like, was he lying or was he told that because there was missile testing that they didn't want anyone to know about, but it had nothing to do with this? Or were they covering up that the Russian government did something to these hikers? I mean, you know, there are theories about maybe the hikers stumbled across something that they shouldn't have. They saw something they shouldn't have, and they were murdered by the Russian government. And then the scene was staged to baffle investigators.
Which, you know, actually is not less plausible than any of the other theories we've talked about.
No, there's a theory that the one member of the group that was so much older, the 38-year-old, was a KGB spy that was, you know, planted with the group for some reason. And so, you know, all of these theories can kind of converge. Like, maybe there was a spy with them because he needed information that someone had, and then they got too close to a, you know, military thing. And then there was a Yeti. Like, there's...
Right. They just have every... Let's just have it degenerate to Yeti versus aliens.
Yeah, and then they happen to trigger an avalanche in their... Oh, and that's the other thing with the slab avalanche theory is that how would it have been triggered? It's, well, it's from them cutting into the mountainside to make their camp. And it's odd that it would have triggered it hours later, but it could have been that they cut into the mountainside and then like wind blowing snow about, because it's they're in the middle of a blizzard, and it wound up like gradually piling up snow in a way that that the cutting in was... didn't immediately trigger an avalanche, but eventually once the snow built up in a certain place, you know, the weight was such that the avalanche would happen hours later, you know. But then there are those that argue like, well, why would experienced hikers cut into a slope like that? They would know that that could trigger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so the fact that the campsite was even where it is seems suspect. Like, it's kind of one of those, absolutely nothing about the situation is normal. They were also off their planned path. So the easy explanation is, well, they got disoriented by the storm, or conditions were such that they couldn't go on their planned path. So they diverged a little bit and wound up not being able to get to their projected campsite. So they had to make do where they were. But then there's the maybe something, you know, maybe there was a reason that wasn't nature that they were off course, you know, maybe they were forced to pick up the camp here. Maybe it was a setup because they wouldn't have made the camp there. And
yeah, and the one thing about the, like, these were experienced hikers argument is that apart from the 138-year-old, you know, it's two women and six men between the ages of 20 and 23, they weren't that experienced.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care how, like, and that's exactly the prime age to think you're a very experienced hiker and not actually, you know, be that experienced and not have been doing it for that long.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that the experience is, this was not their first trip like this.
Well, sure, like, sure.
They had done these sorts of expeditions, some of them together before, and had been fine.
My point is just like, these aren't experts who are prepared for every situation. Yeah, and, yeah, you know. Right.
And they were all students. They were all students on break that were trying to get back before their, you know, spring semester of classes started. So this wasn't what they did professionally. This was just something they were doing for fun on break. So they were committed hobbyists, but were also very young.
Yeah. My thinking is that they're at the level where you could see how they were experienced enough to take on a challenging route, but not so experienced that when a blizzard hit or when an avalanche struck or when the combination of forces, that they wouldn't necessarily know automatically what to do. So they might make bad decisions. They might panic.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's also, if they're in the middle of a blizzard, like, who's to say that they really had many options?
Oh, sure.
You know,
even if they could see very well where they were going, what they were doing.
Even if they did know, like, this isn't the best place to set up a camp, they also might've thought, but we have no other options. Like, it's either we make camp or we get buried in snow right now. So we might as well make camp.
Yeah, exactly. Well, all the mysteries surrounding this make it a fascinating story. And it's one that people have been, you know, obsessing over for decades. But it also makes it a difficult story to tell as a movie because you don't know what's happening. So I guess the two questions about how to make this a movie are, do you pick one explanation and go with it? But also in terms of, maybe not the tone, but as far as like the format the story takes, you can do this as a sort of first person account of these events unfolding, however you think they unfolded, which is kind of a downer because everyone dies in the end. But you know, you can do that. The Perfect Storm, you know, was this sort of incredible story of a doomed, you know, ship. You can take that angle. You can do somebody investigating after the fact and trying to figure out what happened, and then you can either seriously examine all the credible theories, or you can, you know, oh my God, Mulder, it was aliens. Or you could play that up and just make a Sci-Fi Channel movie out of this where you go with the crazy explanations and, oh, there was a secret nuclear project that these, you know, students uncovered and the Yeti was also there. And it seems a little disrespectful to take this like, you know, fascinating real life story and turn it into something silly, but you could do that if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But the problem is there isn't a satisfying, well, this is the real story of what happened because we just don't know.
Right, right. And so I think because there is no possible way to be like, this is the historically accurate version of what happened because we don't know, you kind of have to lean into the speculative. I don't know that there's a really satisfying movie way to try to take it in a super serious, straightforward historical approach, because you have to end it, we don't actually know.
Right. So, and there is an appeal for like that kind of, you know, there's a long, long tradition of like human against nature, you know, kind of movies of people surviving or not surviving in these really extreme conditions. And so you could do a very like verite, you know, these hikers are having a good time and bonding and having fun, and then things turn bad and things get worse and worse and worse. That could be a really compelling movie, but then you have to commit to a version of events.
Right. And I mean, I think that if you were going to, so there have been numerous novels written speculating on what happened. There have been a few like docuseries. There's been a video game where, which I have not played. I cannot imagine that's a very satisfying video game experience, because no matter what happens, you die. But I feel like this story actually lends itself to kind of a slow burn horror movie. I mean, the mountain itself is named Dead Mountain. In the language of the indigenous people, they call that mountain Don't Go There.
It's like the horror movie cliche of like the old man who warned you like, oh, I wouldn't go into that cabin if I were you. Except right? It's like literally the mountain is named that. That's great.
Yeah, like they went to Don't Go There Mountain and all died mysteriously. So like, I feel like so much of it is kind of primed for that sort of slow burn, something's not right horror movie sort of thing, but where you don't actually get to the real horror of it until kind of the very end, which I think could be very interesting, especially if, I mean, this is a group of friends. There were a lot of interesting interpersonal dynamics, like, you know, one of the women and one of the men used to date and had broken up and were a little concerned about going on this expedition together, you know, now that they were platonic. And so like, this was in one of their diaries. So there's all that sort of like drama of 20 something college students.
Oh yeah. Which again, that seems like a horror movie, because that's always how you start off with exploring those relationships, and then people start dying. I'll also add that for a horror movie, one of the reasons that John Carpenter's The Thing is one of the best horror movies is that if you take away the monster, it's still kind of scary. Like, mm-hmm. It's a bunch of guys holed up in a bunker in Antarctica for the winter. Like, I'm already scared.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think the environment is inherently frightening.
Yeah. I think you could make a great, like, Blair Witch Project kind of movie where for a lot of it, it's just, you know, we're facing the harsh realities of nature. And then maybe they start to tell stories about like, oh, I heard there's a weapons testing site. I heard the Yeti is up here. And like, you introduce all these possibilities and then you pick one to be a gruesome ending.
And because there are all these different theories about what could have happened, like you can draw on multiple ones and weave them into the story as it goes on. So there could be like, they could think something might be hunting them, you know?
Yeah.
That they suspect one member of their party might not be who they say they are. Like, you can have that sort of building dread of like, something's not right here. You know, you have this device of them like writing in their diaries as they go and documenting. And, you know, I think you can even make that feel a little bit ominous of what's happening in the background when these photos are being taken. Like, there's one picture that where the Yeti theory comes from, where there's this blurry figure that looks like he's very tall, like far away. And so it's like, who was that? What was going on when that picture was taken?
And you can do that on film too. You can have in the more mundane scenes when they're, you know, the two exes are trying to be, you know, polite to each other. You just have some big shape lurking, you know, moving just out of frame or, you know, just in the background.
Right. And I mean, there's even like theories that like maybe one of the reasons they were in various stages of undress was because like someone was getting amorous in the tent and then there was a fight and like they got interrupted and like there's all this potential drama. And so I think also if you pulled in something like, you know, a monster or like a secret government experimentation going on nearby, or one of them being a spy. There are all these different ways to kind of build tension, even as they're just kind of hiking and during the non-weird part of the movie.
The funny thing is, you even got like another horror movie trope is a character who has inexplicable knowledge of the monster or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And you've got a, you know, if you have a secret military base, maybe that produces a monster, you've got a student in nuclear physics who's familiar with radiation and.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe, I mean, like, what is this secret institute he was working at? Like, what research was he doing? You know, there's so many questions that, because of how far removed we are in history from it, and because of the fact that it was not really investigated for so long, like, so many of the details have been lost to history. So we don't really know a ton about who these people were. We know just like a very bare outline of, you know, what they were interested in, what their relationships with each other were. And so there are a lot of places you could fill it in and create sort of tension in the group, tension in the environment, and, you know, kind of just build that sense of wrongness, even as they're just taking this, you know, supposedly fun winter break trip.
Right.
Even though it's very, very different, I wound up thinking about Midsummer when I was thinking about this story, because I'm like, a group of college kids like go off on their break trip and then everyone dies.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but that's kind of the thing, right, is that it takes so long to realize like something's not right here. And I mean, you know, in that movie, it's a cult. And I don't think that would be the explanation here, but
that's fine. You don't want to just make the same movie again.
No, not at all.
But you can capture that same kind of tone and
that same feeling of like, these are a group of friends, you know, there are weird tensions in the group, but they're doing something fun together. And then gradually you realize like, this is not going to go well. And also I think that sort of ending where they're all going to die, that works in a horror genre because, you know, that is not atypical. Whereas if you were trying to do something, I think, a little more straightforward.
It's a little hard to sell that ending.
Yeah. But
because,
you know,
so many of the like man versus nature movies are about the triumph of the human spirit. And
right. And this is one where they're not going to overcome nature, if indeed it is just nature that killed them.
Right.
So you need to kind of, I think, it needs to be part of your like pact with the audience, that the audience is okay knowing that this is not going to end well.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm sold on a horror movie then. So do you have anybody in mind to direct?
Well, because of my Midsummer connection in my brain, the first name I thought of was Ari Aster, who I was like, this would be very different, but I feel like can do that, you know, kind of group dynamic, slow burn, like looming dread, and then just the big explosive ending.
Right. But that's I think what you want a director. You want somebody who can capture the tone that you're going for more than, oh, well, this person's, you know, filmed other movies in snow or whatever.
Yeah. And I think with this one, the biggest things that would sell it as a movie isn't necessarily the explanation for how they all died. I think that's kind of the bonus, is that the movie will attempt to explain it, really.
Yeah.
The reason you'd invest in it is because, you know, these nine characters should be compelling. Their relationships with each other should be compelling. And, you know, I think that you're going to need someone who can do ensembles, who can do interesting characters that you want to learn more about and that you're invested in their interactions with each other, because that's the only reason you're going to care why this horrible thing happens to them.
Yeah, of course.
So that was one name I thought of. I also thought of, and I will admit that, like, even though I am pitching a horror movie, I am not a horror movie aficionado. So I was doing some research into this and I was like, who would fit? And so some of these that I feel like would fit are from things I haven't even seen. I just feel like they'd be right. But one person that came to mind based on things I have seen is also Mike Flanagan, who I feel like isn't an immediate choice for this sort of outdoor big nature thing. But I was thinking of, because I recently watched Haunting of Hill House and Haunting of Bly Manor, which both also have that sort of slow burn, like, sense of wrongness, but he really, really focuses on the characters and their relationships with each other, so that, you know, when everything goes sideways, you feel something. It's not just the terror of the moment. It's like this deep sense of like loss because of how connected you were to those people. And even though those are both, you know, mini series, I feel like he's got a really good grasp of character and relationship that I think would be necessary in this sort of small ensemble cast movie.
Yeah. And he also recently did like Gerald's Game and Dr. Sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think it captured that sort of sense of growing unease that you want under this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm also not a big horror buff. And so, and also I hadn't thought about, until you brought it up, I hadn't thought about doing this as a horror movie, although it makes so much sense. The first name, just because she just won the Oscar, was Chloe Zhao. Mm-hmm. Because all of her movies are sort of about people in distress bonding in an unforgiving landscape.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a very different kind of unforgiving landscape. Although I think now that she's an Oscar winner and in the Marvel pantheon, I'm not sure we can get her for our imaginary movie.
Yeah, but who knows? Maybe she wants to do a horror movie. Like,
yeah, it could be. I was also thinking of Deborah Granik, who directed Winter's Bone and Leave No Trace.
Because mm-hmm.
Leave No Trace is about a vet with PTSD who raises his young daughter in the woods. And so much of it is just about the joys and harsh realities of nature. And it doesn't necessarily have that impending dread because it's a lot. But it's first and foremost about the father-daughter relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And basically his inability to live around other people and how she gradually sort of warms up to that and that puts a distance between them. Like, that's the kind of like personal story you want at the heart of this. And I don't know that she has the like growing sense of unease horror chops for this, but she's just somebody who, like, mm-hmm. Winter's Bone was terrific, and she's really kind of only done those two films. She's done a couple of short documentaries, and it's just somebody who I think is great and deserves more work.
Yeah. A couple others I had researched, which I haven't seen their movies, but now I kind of want to, are David Bruckner, who did The Ritual, which is, I was looking at like slow burn horror movies, and that one is where your friends go into the woods and everything goes wrong.
Okay. I don't know that one.
Yeah, group of hikers going into the woods and everything, and gradually everything goes wrong. But I was like, oh, group of friends, hiking, you know, going off the beaten path. Like, all the reviews I was reading for that one said that it was like a good, like, building tension, like gradual before you figure out what's going on thing. And I'm like, I think that's really what this would need. And another one that came to mind, which is another movie I have not seen, but have had recommended to me, is Karen Kusama, who did The Invitation, which is not on its surface similar to this, because that movie is all very contained within like a house, whereas this one would be, you know, in the Ural Mountains.
Right.
But it's kind of the same sense of it's an ensemble cast in a confined space. And even though, you know, the Dyatlov Pass would have been in this wide open space, it still feels confined by just the very nature of what they're doing. So I think that actually kind of worked. And it's also this kind of a movie where it's gradually these characters are realizing like something is wrong here and, you know, everything's about to go sideways.
And at least a certain amount of it, especially when the incident actually happens, they're intense when it's, you know, the conditions are unbearable outside and you are kind of in this claustrophobic space.
Yeah. And I think you could actually, with, you know, since they do go for several days before whatever happens to them happens, like, you know, they started on trains, they go trains and then they catch a ride on a truck. And then, so it goes from these very like kind of more open places with people to these increasingly confined spaces. And you have them, you know, nights with them in tents. And I feel like you can build that sense of like, kind of like the walls closing in, even though they're out in the open, by showing, you know, the first couple nights that they're out there in their tents and what that's like having this whole group kind of mashed into this smaller space.
Oh yeah. And you had mentioned the theory that like they changed their route at some point because conditions forced them to. So you do kind of have this, even though you're out in the open, the number of places you can go and the number of choices available to you just get, you know, narrower and narrower. Mm-hmm. And so there's that kind of like, kind of emotional claustrophobia, even if it isn't literal, even if you're still outdoors, if your choices are limited and places you can go are limited,
yeah,
you still kind of have that same oppressive feeling.
Yeah. And I mean, even with the route being changed and the camping in the, you know, far from ideal site, like you kind of get this sense in the narrative that they're like being herded by nature, like being penned into.
Oh yeah. I like that.
That are, you know, going to kill them. And so if you have them kind of aware of that as they're going along, like knowing this is not where we need to be going, I do not feel good about this, but we have no other choices. you can get that sense of kind of being penned into somewhere they don't want to be, which would build that sense of dread.
And it's such a great storytelling thing to have somebody make a bad choice that they know is a bad choice because they don't have any better choices.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, the best of the worst choices.
Yeah, like there's George R. R. Martin mentioned this as a trick that he does in Game of Thrones often, like in the books, is to have somebody argue against making a decision and then have them be the one to make that decision because they realize that they have to for, you know, one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
Then when something goes wrong, they're both responsible for it and should have known better.
Yeah. And then you can lampshade all of those parts in these theories. People are like, well, experienced hikers wouldn't do that. But if you have them know that they shouldn't be doing that.
Well, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have them arguing. That's also building tension in the group. If you have members arguing, you know, we shouldn't do this. This is a horrible idea. And then, you know, the leaders of the group being like, yeah, but we have to, you know, because, you know, what is your better option? And they don't have a better option.
Well, exactly. And if you're faced with two bad choices, whichever one you make, when things start to go wrong, then it's kind of on you for making that choice, even if things would have gone even worse than the other choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're in this no-win situation, and then those can just compound and compound.
Yeah. And even like, so if you've got a conflict building within the group, like first when they have to veer off their path, and second when they have to build a camp where they know they shouldn't build a camp, then that could even then feed into why did they split up? You know, maybe it's not that they just stumbled out and got separated. Maybe it's that one group was pissed off with another group and they made a conscious choice. Like, I'm not going with you. I'm going to do my own thing. And that winds up being, you know, another kind of fatal decision there.
Right, right. I mean, that's the classic worm of people under.
Yeah, yeah.
You never go off on your own.
Exactly, exactly. And especially if there's like, you know, a Yeti.
Right, exactly.
They've been dismissing this whole movie is like, surely that's not really a thing. But, you know, we, the viewer, know it is, or, you know, just some sort of, you know, odd external factor that they're not accounting for, but we know is there. Because you have to account for everything. And so since you can't Occam's razor it, and since it is a movie and movies, you kind of want to go in the unlikely direction, like why not pick a few of the more outlandish theories and weave them in, but do them maybe even in a more incidental way. Like maybe the Yeti doesn't kill them. Maybe the Yeti is just responsible for taking their eyeballs post-mortem.
And that is the prevailing theory with the missing eyeballs and tongue and stuff, like after, is that just long after the fact animals got to them, because it did take
years
to discover them.
Yeah, I mean, they were like the
but in a horror movie setting, you can have all sorts of fun with that.
Yeah, and I mean, the boring explanation, the medical examiner is like, I mean, these were post-mortem injuries. It also is possible it was just like decomposition. And
well, sure, yeah, yeah.
It's like, well, but that's not interesting. And also they were found months later, so you can't actually say for sure how long post-mortem it was.
Yeah. But I like the idea, like you could introduce the secret, you know, the secret base where they're doing weird experiments and stuff, but have that not be the cause. But maybe that's the reason that they go in a different direction, or it causes some tension, or, you know, something.
Yeah, maybe these external factors are just one of the things that are raising tension within the group because they're a little freaked out, you know?
And right.
Maybe that response, maybe we get radiation on the clothing well before they die, and it actually doesn't have anything to do with why they die. It's just like, maybe there are missiles testing, and maybe there is some sort of like debris that gets blown into them by the wind.
I feel like you almost want like a framing device, like an opening scene in the present establishing this mystery, and that, well, these are all these telltale signs that we can't explain, and then go through them one by one and, you know, give all these explanations, even if they're far-fetched, or because it doesn't, if you're just following the story from start to finish and you're not familiar with the background, then why does it matter if there's radiation?
Right.
You know,
right.
It matters to us because it's part of this mystery.
Right. And so I don't know if you do like a scene or if you just do like a card that, you know, is like in 1959, kind of what you did
in
the podcast of just like break down, like these hikers were found dead. Like here were the conditions, you know, and just, so let the viewers know all of this will have to be explained at some point.
Right. Right. Or maybe you just let your story be your story and then leave that as an Easter egg for people who are familiar with the story. They're like, ah, the radiation, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think it could work either way. You could let them know up front, like, this is what really happened, and now we're going to go do our horror movie explanation for it. or you could just do it as a straightforward like horror movie with a kind of a touch of the speculative in there, but it would be just like possibly just a lot of red herrings of, is that going to be what kills them? Is that going to be what kills them?
Like, right. Yeah. I feel like you do almost want to establish at the beginning that they'd all die so that you can keep guessing like that.
Mm-hmm. And you could even start with the one guy who left, like the 10th member of the expedition.
Oh yeah.
A day in, like open with him, maybe even like either telling his story, because he also was kind of into the conspiracy theories. Like he doesn't buy the avalanche natural causes explanation. He thinks there was a cover up. Like,
and that guy just fascinates me just from the fact that he walked away and survived, but yet has to have been haunted by all these people he was presumably friends with.
Yeah. So you can either open by picking up with him years down the line and him thinking about, looking back. Or you could open with him right when he finds out about it. Like there are so many options to pick up after it's already happened, because you have this survivor that really exists, and then go back and pick up, what really happens.
It's amazing. As little as we know about the real story, the real life story gives us so many movie elements that we want.
Yeah, it's like the real life story gives us just enough information to make a really fascinating movie that incorporates all the details we do know, but has so much freedom to go in all sorts of different directions, because you can't be beholden to a narrative you don't know.
Yeah.
And so there is no such thing as historically accurate. All that we could do is be accurate to, the time period and to the details that we've learned way after the fact.
Right. But it still gives you so much leeway for explaining mm-hmm. what actually happened.
Yeah. I mean, you could even say that it's historically accurate, even if you do throw in an alien, because it's like, we don't know.
Right. And like, horror movies are, not famous for sticking to real life events even when they're based on.
Right.
It's just a good jumping off point of, an interesting story that you can make something out of.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I've been kind of toying with the idea. I'm like, you could even possibly update it and set it in a more modern time and say, this is inspired by the Dyatlov Pass.
Yeah.
But again, because we don't know what happened, like we've changed something. And then you could, update it a little bit to be a little more modern in the dialogue and the character dynamics and the casting and all of that. And that's the thing, is since we don't know what happened, we don't know, like, would updating, like giving them more modern technology have changed anything? Like,
right.
We don't know. So, I mean, that would be one possible way to go to it, is make it, a modern day setting and make the American hikers. And also, I don't really know a lot of Russian actors, so. Give them names that Americans can pronounce. Or you could do a mix, set it historically, but change some of the details to make it a little more accessible. Because unless it's going to be a Russian film, like, I am not qualified to speak on who should star in or direct a Russian film.
Well, yeah. And yeah, the names of the survivors are all recorded in, Igor, Yuri, Georgie, Alexander.
Oh yeah, the first names you can.
This is Anita and a Lyudmila.
Yeah, you've got two Yuris.
Oh yeah, that's always.
So one.
Oh,
of them
so. Is yeah, Yuri Yudin's the one who left.
Yeah, Yuri Yudin left. Yuri Doroshenko stayed, and died. And then we've got two Alexanders, an Igor. So these people would at least need some nicknames if American audiences are going to.
Yeah, that's true. And I feel like you could probably change, one of the Yuris to an Ivan or fudge it a little bit. And as always with basing things loosely on history, you're sometimes better off changing the names and not trying to represent actual people who still have mourning relatives and whatever else.
Especially if you're going to like manufacture a lot of drama that may or may not have existed. Like maybe that's a one-to-one analog for every member of this expedition.
Well, exactly. And as far as the story goes, there aren't that many members of the expedition that need a one-to-one analog. Maybe you want to match the bare facts that there were seven men and two women, and all but one were in their early 20s. But I don't think there's nothing that we know about these people individually other than that one of them was studying, you know, nuclear physics. And
there are bits and pieces, but it's all basically like, you know, based on what they were studying in school. You know, they had several of them were keeping diaries, but there weren't a ton of like really deep personal insights in there. So
and it makes the casting tough because there isn't so much that stands out. Well, this person has to be played by this actor. They're kind of interchangeable.
Yeah. So when I was thinking of actors for it, I mean, I kind of went with my typical approach to anything casting is I'm like, I don't want to, even though they were all white people, I'm like, I need to diversify my casting. I need to go more colorblind in the casting, you know. And
well, I think that can be a tough sell if you're setting this in Russia in 1959, but if you modernize it, absolutely. Even if it's not American.
Which is one of the reasons I was like, mate, can you modernize this? And I think you could. It's harder if you're doing it in Russia, but then again, like diversified historicals are becoming more of a thing lately.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, where it's just like, this isn't what they looked like. And also we don't care. But
there's also like a growing acknowledgement that, you know, actual historical Europe was not as blindingly white as we, you know, pretend it was raised to believe that it was.
So, I mean, in my cast list, I just paid more attention to who would be interesting in this group and less, you know, what these hikers actually looked like. I thought, well, first of all, I think for the 38-year-old, you need someone that's going to fit in with a bunch of younger kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And like be able to buy like, yeah, I get that this guy would go on this trip with a bunch of kids that could be his kids. But, you know, he was also like this former soldier and like outdoorsman. And so I was thinking someone like Jake Gyllenhaal-y.
Oh, yeah.
Or like an Oscar Isaac, like, or I thought even like someone like Riz Ahmed, who I'm like, these are people that are in their 30s, you know, late 30s, but I would buy them with this group of younger kids as the sort of more experienced older person who also may or may not be a spy.
Right, right. I was thinking along similar lines because I had Chris Pine.
Uh-huh.
Because he's somebody who can... Like, I sort of imagine that the 38-year-old is the experienced hiker and is somebody kind of rugged and outdoorsy, and he can play that. But he could also play somebody who, like, can hang with the younger folks.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I don't know, I just landed on him because he's almost exclusively done big-budget popcorn movies like Star Trek and Wrinkle in Time. But I feel like of all the Chrises, he's the one with some acting chops we haven't really seen. Mm-hmm. And he hasn't done a ton of small movies. And so, I don't know, I just think it'd be fun to see him stretch out a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I could see him. I was looking through like lists of actors that were kind of the right age bracket. And I did it like think of it. I was like, I think he could do it. I wanted someone. I almost feel like Chris Pine is almost a little too movie star.
That was my one reservation. But I started off thinking it might be worth doing this with mostly unknown actors.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
Then, but for the purposes of this show, you can't really just name a bunch of unknown actors.
Yeah,
and the audience is going to be on board of it.
I think if it were to really exist, it would be a nice to have a smattering of like kind of younger up and comers with kind of unknowns, because again, they all die. So there's not going to be an obvious like, oh, this person is well known, so they're going to be the one that survives. Like,
yeah, exactly. Like the Law and Order thing where like the special guest star is clearly the murderer because.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, why would they get this person otherwise?
So I was thinking the one that would probably be most likely to be a more big name would be the 38-year-old, even though he wasn't the leader, you know, of the expedition. He, like, Igor Dyatlov was the leader, and that's why it's named after him.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like that's just because that's the name and he was leader of the expedition. That's also probably where you put either your big name actor or just your, like, that's kind of your main character or sort of the person who leads the ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's that's the name of the show. Like, it's. But that's also a place for red herring where, you know, you establish that Igor Dyatlov is the leader of the exposition and then maybe things change very quickly and that person isn't the focus of the movie or
yeah,
and isn't, I mean, isn't the one calling the shots. Or...
Yeah, and I think with 9 main characters, you know, you're obviously going to have a few that are going to get more, but I don't think you're going to have a decided protagonist. Like, I would hope it would be more like, you know, three or four that are carrying the bulk of the narrative weight. And then the
that makes sense.
Yeah. So, and then in my thinking of who would make up this group, I also am not opposed to gender bending them. To have, you know, to even out this 7-2 dynamic maybe a little bit. I mean, I think it could also work as is. I never want to really limit myself when I'm thinking. I'm like, well, I can only have two women, so.
Of course, of course. And again, like the specifics don't matter so much as the what happened to the group. And so, yeah, there's no real reason you're stuck with this.
And especially if you're modernizing it, like there's no reason you can't just like kind of play fast and loose with the makeup of the group, because obviously who they were mattered. They were real people. But did it impact what happened to them? Like, who knows? Like, we have no idea whether it was what happened to them was the group dynamic, you know, and how much of that was influenced by the fact that it was seven men and two women, or whether it was just mostly completely external factors outside their control.
Right.
So some names that I was thinking of, again, because I kept going to the Midsummer place, was Florence Pugh.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I thought she would really do like doomed Russian hiker really well. I thought of Anya Taylor-Joy because...
Oh, yeah, I had her on my list too.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, she's horror movie royalty, so obviously she would do well in this. I thought Lakeith Stanfield might be a really interesting member of the group.
I think his name has come up in every episode of this podcast because he should be in every movie.
Yes, he should. But he's just got such an interesting energy to him. And I could really buy him as, you know, this, like all of the people I thought of, I was like, would I buy them as really committed hobbyist hikers and skiers? And like, yes, yes for all of these people. But also, would they just be interesting to watch interact? And I think he's always interesting.
Oh, yeah. And I also feel like he can play anything.
Yeah, yeah. Which really would help with that whole, like, what's going on with this group? Like, who do we trust here? Is someone, like, a lot of these people can do layers really, really well, so they can be very affable and friendly, but you can also buy that they might be having some secrets.
Yeah.
And are those secrets benign or are they dangerous? Like, we don't know. It could be anything. And so I think he does that really well. I have Julia Garner on my list. She can do kind of quiet and having a lot play under the surface. So I thought she might make a nice kind of secondary character. You can always tell there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, and you want that, especially when you get to the point where you start to question people's motivations. Is she being very quiet because she's secretly terrified or because she has something to hide?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who else do I have? I have John Boyega. I just enjoy him.
And I think, yeah, he's just, again, somebody you can put in anything because he's just so much fun to watch on screen. And
yeah, and I think you need a few of those like kind of bigger personalities in this group combined with the kind of quieter, smaller personalities. And I think he could do that kind of like, you know, boisterous, like glue that holds the group together sort of.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it's also good for the group dynamic because the boisterous sort of outgoing people are the ones who tend to get listened to.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, and then maybe the quiet characters have to come into the fore and say, you know, hey, you've been leading us the wrong way, we need to do this.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's anything that can add more tension into the group, I think is worth exploring.
Mm-hmm. I got Alexander Ludwig. I don't know if you watch Vikings.
Oh, no, I don't know.
Oh, he was in Hunger Games. He was Cato in the first Hunger Games, but he's on Vikings. He plays Bjorn Ironside, the son of Ragnar. And he's just got a really, like, interesting presence to him. He's very authoritative and can be kind of intimidating, but also has, like, kind of an affableness to him. And so I would totally buy him as the student hiker that I thought would be good to butt heads with someone. Like, he can do that kind of stubborn, imposing thing without being completely off-putting.
Yeah.
So he's one that I thought I would buy as he's actually a friend, but also could be kind of the one that's instigating some of the conflict.
Yeah.
Who else? I have Stephan James. I thought he's a fun from he was in If Beale Street Could Talk.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, again, I'm just like I'm trying to just load the pot with different energies. He's got kind of a subtler
And that's you know, that's the fun of casting one of these. Mm-hmm. Is just like what actors do you want to see bouncing off of each other?
Yeah. I threw Zendaya in the mix because I also want to see her in everything.
Yeah, she also comes up a lot in the show because
Amanda Stenberg. Yeah, she they would be one of the younger ones, I think, but I think their roles show a lot of weight. They have a lot of weight to the roles they pick. Lana Condor, who's just kind of a bubbly ball of happiness.
I actually think that's great, a great like energy to put into this.
Yeah, like,
you know, because you know it's a story of doomed hikers. It's going to be oppressive. You kind of need somebody to lighten it up, but you also maybe it's almost weirdly a source of tension if things are looking bad and somebody's just unfailingly, you know, happy and upbeat.
Yeah. Well, and it's always just like, you know, again, if you're really invested, you ought, and you're kind of subverting tropes, right? Is like the kind, happy, funny one is typically not the one that's going to die horribly, but but they all, again, no one is exempt. And so I think, and I also was just trying to think, like, who would actually be friends? Like, who would I just enjoy seeing them if you put them in a room together and give them nothing? Who do I think would actually just still be interesting to watch?
Oh yeah. Well, that's the other thing. You have all these very likable actors, mm-hmm. and you know, it hits harder when somebody dies gruesomely, when there's somebody that you like have grown to like and have affection for in this movie, but also maybe just have affection for as an actor because of other things you've seen them in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, so those are some of my names. Those are actors in their 20s who I thought would be great. I mean, they're all a little older than these people actually were, but also it's Hollywood, so.
Yeah, exactly. And if we're departing from the specifics of the story in a couple of other ways, you can certainly fudge the ages a little bit.
Yeah, well, and I mean, you know, if you were to modernize it, you know, instead of having them in their undergrad, you could make them graduate students. Like, they're in their 20s. It's very easy to buy all of that.
Yeah, it really just the relevant thing is just that they're young people. And yeah. So precisely how young doesn't really matter. Although I kept running into problems when I was trying to cast this. Another running joke in the show is that I always, if I need young actors, I just go to the Stranger Things cast first. But they're all too young. They're all still like 16.
Yeah. And you need to buy that they'd be in college and doing this giant expedition.
Yeah, a lot of the first names I thought of, like Daphne Keene, is still 16, and they're all too young. So I only had a few people that you haven't already, you know, besides you've already mentioned. Alex Lawther from End of the Fucking World.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he has like a weird intense energy and...
does, yeah.
And then I had mentioned Debra Granick's movie Leave No Trace. Mm-hmm. And the young actress who was in that, Thomasin McKenzie, mm-hmm. was, you know, I don't know exactly how old she was, but this movie was from a few years ago. So she was pretty young and sort of carried that movie on her shoulders. And I thought it would be good in this. And then Kiernan Shipka is just another young actress who was fantastic in Mad Men and, you know, just deserves lots more chances. And that's kind of all I got.
Yeah, I was looking at some of the younger ones and I was just like, would I buy them on screen as, you know, even though I know that in real life, these hikers are in their early 20s. And, you know, nowadays actors in their early 20s look, they play 16-year-olds. And so that's kind of where I went with a little bit older, because I'm like, we're not used to seeing 22-year-olds play their age. Like,
oh, exactly.
Tom Holland in Spider-Man, like, right? He's, you know, in his early 20s playing a teenager.
Yeah, and that's been the way of casting high schoolers for so long, going back to, like, you know, 35-year-old Stalker Channing in Grease.
Right. So it's like, would it throw viewers off to try to be passing these people off as their actual ages, because we're just so used to not seeing that.
Right. I mean, I always love it when they cast actual high school age actors as high school students, which doesn't happen that often.
Yes. I mean, I think everyone you listed definitely has the right like energy for it, where I'm like, those are actually all names I kind of lingered over too. And the reason they didn't make my list is I'm like, I just don't know if it would feel right, or if it would feel like watching a bunch of children.
Right. But I think there's something for that, that like it makes these characters all the more vulnerable if you're even seeing them younger than they are. And this, apart from, you know, Semyon Zolotarov, the 38-year-old, this was just a bunch of kids.
It was.
Going out in the woods who got, you know, or going up into the mountains who very quickly got in over their heads.
Well, and the other question is, if you put a 38-year-old with, like, you know, Kiernan Shipka, is that going to look weird? Like, is that going to
be,
you know, and that's, I mean, it's a horror movie, so you want to lean into the weird and creepy, but it's like, do you want it to be creepy in that way of like, what is this man doing, grown man doing with all these children?
But at the same time, assuming you're sticking with the, you know, the relative ages of the characters, that is going to be kind of hanging over this.
Oh yeah. And I mean, I think there will always be something a little off about that age gap. Like, what is this guy even doing here?
Which I thought he was like maybe the guide they had hired or something. And then I read more of the story. Like, nope, he just was hanging out with these college students.
Yeah. And so, which is why I think you actually do need to cast someone very likable in that role to kind of offset the inherent creepiness of this very broad age gap. So it's like you put a Chris Pine or a Jake Gyllenhaal in there and you're like, well, I really like this actor.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like you want the audience to kind of give it a pass at first and be like, well, that seems a little odd, but I'm just going to let it ride.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can kind of play into that. Should I have given that a pass as it goes?
Well, Jake Gyllenhaal, I think in particular, is great for that because he can play the very affable, you know, lovable guy. And he can also play a huge creep.
Yes. And he can do both in the same movie.
Yeah. And you can do either arc where, you know, maybe some of the young women in the group are like, why is this old dude hanging out with us? And then it turns out, oh, actually, his motives are completely pure and he's just a decent guy. Or you go the other way, like, hey, look at our buddy here. Like, oh, no, he's a creep. You can kind of, you can go in either direction there.
And I think a fun dynamic to do with the cast would be, you know, give us a group that you buy as these are all friends, but also, you know, the obvious one at first that you're like, why is this person here is the 38-year-old. And you can kind of ride that line of, is this normal or is it weird? But you can actually do that with multiple members of the group where as you kind of go through and you tease out the dynamic between them, you can have multiple members where you're kind of questioning their motives of why are they here? Why are they in this group? Like, I bought it up front. And I get why they'd all be comfortable enough with each other to go on this expedition together. That requires a high level of trust if you're going to go and do this with this group completely removed from the rest of society. You have to be able to trust everyone you're with and like everyone you're with. But also, you know, give your audience the question of like, oh, maybe this person isn't there for the right reasons. Or maybe this person has something they're hiding, you know.
Oh yeah. And think about how these groups come together when you're just going on a trip in college or really at any age. Mm-hmm. There's so many things of like, well, I don't really know this person, but she is friends with him, so I guess we have to invite him. Or, well, this guy, I don't know this guy well, but he knows hiking and, you know, he knows this mountain. And so let's invite him along. And then, you know, if we invite this person. If we invite this person, we can't invite this other person. I don't know if I want my ex to be there. Like there's so many dynamics. And so the result is, you get a group where there's some close friendships and there's some like, I don't really know how I feel about this person. Mm-hmm. And maybe people who don't know each other that well, and maybe people who do know each other that well and don't like each other for that reason. Mm-hmm. And so there's so many different relationships you can get into and explore.
Yeah. And with 9, like that's such a good number for a movie because that's big enough that you can have like little alliances forming. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Little pockets of trust and little pockets of distrust and have all this simmering tension in the group that's there well before things go dramatically south.
And groups of, you know, sort of opposing groups that can overlap in different ways.
Exactly, yeah. And the character that's playing all the groups, you know?
Oh yeah, yeah.
A friend to everyone that's really a friend to no one. Like, and I think so many of these actors can do that sort of complexity of relationships that make you really buy into like, what's going on just with this group of people and then, oh, what's happening to this group of people. I think the trick of this movie would be to balance that internal conflict within the group with the external, whatever it is that's going to kill them.
That's the thing that always gets me with movies because, you know, they get sold based on a hook, mm-hmm. which is that like hikers are, you know, stranded in the woods and all sorts of disaster befalls them. Horror movie. Okay. You got a green light. But in terms of actually making it, you can add so much depth to this just by writing all those relationships and writing all those things. And the thing that always gets me is like, writing is the cheapest part of making a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And why doesn't every movie do that?
Right,
you know,
right.
So many seem like they got the hook, like that's enough. We don't need to worry about the...
Yeah. And I mean, the reason that I'm not a horror movie aficionado, and I mean, one, I'm a giant wimp, but really for so long, I was like, I'm not interested in how people die horribly. I'm interested in who they are. Like I'm interested in the characters.
Yeah, and exactly.
It wasn't until like the last few years that I realized I've just been watching the wrong horror movies, because
yeah.
a lot of people really do lean into that whole, like, we're going to make you really care about these characters. You really care about what happens to them, which should be true of every movie, but it's not. So I think with Dyatlov Pass, the trick is, because it's such a spectacularly odd story, the impulse is going to be lean into the circumstances of what happened to them. Whereas I think the real interest is like making you care about the characters, so you care that it happened to them, not just about the circumstances, but that it happened to them specifically.
Right. I actually think that's a big argument for modernizing it a little bit and having a more diverse cast, because if everybody is a, you know, 20 to 23 year old Russian male, like everybody gets to be a little interchangeable. And sometimes that can be okay for a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like if you have a more diverse cast, everybody stands out from everybody else. You have more of a reason to be invested with them as individuals and not just this kind of monotone group.
And it's not like Russia is this giant open book now, so that the secrecy and the cover-up wouldn't be applicable anymore.
Oh, exactly.
So, I mean, you can still have, especially like if you send Americans into Russia and they're, you know, like you could totally buy that there was a giant Russian military cover-up around what happened to them.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
By embedded in their group, or, you know, any number of those theories from 1959 could easily translate today, because like it's not the Soviet Union anymore, but like Russia still has its fair share of skeletons in the closet, and you could totally buy that this would be one even if it were to take place now.
Oh yeah, even the radiation,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the 50s, you know, some sort of secret nuclear test site was a very like current and compelling thing, but Putin assassinates people with polonium. It's like his signature. It's like his mark of Zorro, you know, like maybe one of these people is a spy and they've just, you know, they're on this hike just to hide out after, you know, murdering somebody or something, you know, something. There's all sorts of possibilities.
It's their River Wild escape.
Right. But the, you know,
now I'm going to take a weird outdoors trip to escape.
Right. Yeah. Maybe there's some 11th member of this that kills everybody else and gets away with it.
One of the theories was, which has been completely debunked, was that like the indigenous people of the area attacked them for coming onto the land, but that was dismissed because they're like, there are no external tracks, there are no indications that any other people were there, it was just these 9 people.
Yeah, you can't do that and not leave any trace.
Yeah, you can't bring in that there was someone else, unless it literally is like an alien beamed down and then beamed back up and left no tracks.
Right.
Or the Russian government like sprayed over the tracks with snow, and like it would have to take a very big conspiracy.
Or the Yeti. Let's not rule out the Yeti.
Never rule out the Yeti. You know, the Yeti is well versed in covering his tracks, though. For
exactly, yeah.
That's part of Yeti's school.
Well, I think the Yeti's as good a place as any to end. So that's our movie. Thanks again to Lauren Thoman. You can find her on Twitter at Lauren Thoman, and you can find all of her writing at laurenthomanwrites.com. If you have any thoughts on Dyatlov Pass or ideas for other movies that need to get made, hit us up on Twitter at YMovie. You can find my column Wookiee Wormhole in the AV Club every Sunday, and you can read student journalism, hear college radio, and listen to other lesser podcasts on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. Stay safe out there, get your shot, keep yourself sane. We'll be back next time on
Why is this not a movie?